saw that video the other day on YouTube. It looked so cutting edge so many years ago, but I'll tell you, it looks really primitive now. And another prophetic song. So this one goes out to our friends at the NSA. I know you know what we do because you do it too. So let's just remember that. And speaking about everyone being human, you know, people don't mean to mess up. They just do. And let us remember our first responders, police departments. You know, I know this this young guy. He's a policeman. He's got a little bit of an attitude. And I wondered what his attitude was all about. He had a little bit of an attitude, a little edgy for a young guy. It's like, what's up with this? Well, come to find out, his brother was killed by a drunk driver. So rule number one, your papers should be in order. Your driver's license, your insurance. When the policeman comes up, be polite. Don't smart off. Don't smart off. Don't assert yourself. Be polite. That's the moral imperative. Take it from there. Next on the program, Peter Lance, five-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter, now working as a screenwriter and novelist. He's got a new one out called Deal with the Devil, the FBI secret 30-year relationship with the mafia killer. He has several other books, Triple Cross, Al Bin Laden's Master Spy, Penetrated the CIA, the FBI, and the Green Beret. Another one of his books, A Thousand Years for Revenge, International Terrorism, and yes, the FBI. And another one called Cover Up, What the Government is Still Hiding About, The War on Terror. We're going to talk about several elements of his various works. It's a staggering amount of work. It really is. He sent me several links, and I'm just going, wow, this is a tsunami of data. So I'm going to let Peter carry most of the conversation because he knows what he's talking about and he is not a man who is ever at a loss for words. Again, his new book is Deal with the Devil, and you can check out his website while we wait for this little break to go by. It is peterlance.com, P-E-T-E-R-L-A-N-C-E, peterlance.com, and he's our guest for the remainder of the program on Coast to Coast AM. All right, without further ado, let us bring upon the bridge of the mothership, Peter Lance. Hey, Peter, how are you?
Good to be with you, John. How's it going down in Texas tonight?
Well, that's not too bad, not too bad. I'm hovering over central Texas right now in the great big bad to the bone mothership here. And I'll tell you, I'm pretty jacked up out here on Independence weekend. And I'll tell you, after speaking with you briefly earlier about the, that whole thing where the plane comes in today, I just thought it was coincidental, to say the least, that that while you did not really get into this very much when you spoke with George Norrie on the 21st of May, we might take a look at some of the TWA 800 particulars, especially since a couple of weeks ago, everybody, it was all the rage, and then it was a flare, and then it just went away again.
Right.
Happy. So, yeah. Well, let's do it. Now, this deal today, it just looks to, I wasn't there, but it looks to me like either somebody went on manual or there was a little glitch in the machine, but it got kind of low and flared a little bit too quick and busted the tail off on the way to the end of the runway. That's kind of what it looks like, and a couple of people were lost, and it's a sad deal. But this TWA 800, it was for so many months, it was, well, we saw a missile going up to the airplane. We saw a flare. It couldn't be a flare. I think it was a missile. And blah, blah, and it was just like, whatever. And then the FBI just recently came out and went, look, we didn't see any evidence of any missile at all. But there was some explosive residue somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote my second book, Cover Up, was supposed to be entirely about the 9/11 Commission. In front of which I testified, although they took my testimony in a windowless conference room at 26 Federal Plaza. There was no stenographer, no recording equipment. The guy who took my testimony was Dietrich Snell, who was a senior counsel to the commission, who should have been a witness because Snell was one of the federal officials who I pretty much prove in my first book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, received evidence from the Philippines National Police in 1995. Of what amounted to this planes as missiles crash plot, and which Ramzi Youssef, the original World Trade Center bomber, designed, and it was ultimately carried out by his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And the Philippines National Police, when I went to the Philippines and met with Colonel Rodolfo Mendoza in 2002, he gave me like 2 or 3 inches thick a pile of formerly classified documents, which had the name of Khalid Sheikh all over them. And basically, you know, I proved in my first book, A Thousand Years, that they hatched the plot they call the Plains Operation in Manila in 1994. It was one of three plots. And the feds, the Southern District feds, were informed about this by the Philippines National Police. I actually talked to the diplomatic security agent who carried the intelligence from Camp Crema, the military base where Yusef's partner, Abdul Hakim Murad, had been interrogated for over 60 days. And he saw the material being addressed to the Southern District prosecutor, Dietrich Snell, who was one of the two prosecutors. Mike Garcia and Dietrich Snell were prosecuting Yusef first for what was called the Bojinka case. And that was a fiendish plot to smuggle on board a dozen U.S. airliners inbound from Asia, the components of improvised explosive devices. And they would essentially build them on board the first leg of the flight. They'd put them in the life jacket pouch above the center wing fuel tank of the plane, and they'd get off when the planes landed. So you'd get like a flight from, let's say, Hong Kong to Singapore that was then going to go on to San Francisco, or a flight from Bangkok to Narita in Japan that was going to go on to Los Angeles. They'd put the bomb on board the first leg, and it would act, they'd get off, and then when the bomb was over the plane was over the Pacific, boom, you know, it would blow down like a blasting cap and detonate the fuel tank. And Yusef had actually done what he called a wet test on a Philippine Airlines Boeing 747-100, identical kind of aircraft to the TWA-800 aircraft. He did a wet test, he called it, on December 11th, 1994. Now, if you go to peterlance.com, my website, because you and I talked about this, John, I prepared a little page on this. It's on the lower right. It's 2 or 3 down on the right-hand side on my homepage, peterlance.com. And in it, I have a link to the San Francisco Chronicle did a piece this week in which they cited my work. And then the Wikipedia, which I have zero control over.
Right, nobody does.
An article on, you can't do anything with Wikipedia if you're involved, as you know. And they had their main piece on alternate bomb theories actually devotes more space to my theory than any other. And they, so I reproduced the Wikipedia thing, and I also reproduced an extraordinary document which links this TWA-800 story into the mafia story that I hope we can at least spend a couple of hours on tonight, because my new book has some jaw-dropping revelations in it. But because I didn't have a chance to, you know, George and I talked about this years ago, TWA-800 theory, but because of this recent interest in it and the fact that the FBI, everybody just, from Anderson Cooper, everybody just rolled over and bought the FBI's version of events, that the FBI ultimately sanctioned the theory of the NTSB that there was a short in the electrical fuel, and there was an electrical short in the center wing fuel tank that caused vapors to explode, decapitating the plane and causing the crash. I'll shut up now because I've been doing a soliloquy here if you want to ask me some questions. But I believe that I have the most plausible theory for the crash of TWA-800, and I believe it was an al-Qaeda bomb. I believe it was Bojinka fulfilled, and it happened when Ramzi Youssef, on the eve of the most damaging evidence going into evidence in the Bojinka trial, where he was being tried for this Manila air bomb plot in the Southern District.
Just keep rolling, Peter. It's okay with me. Believe me, we got a lot of time here.
Autopilot tonight, John. I think you just figured, what the heck. All right. If you don't mind, because sometimes, people think, well, Lance drones on forever. But let me just tell you what I found, okay?
I would only say, just give everybody a chance to grasp these names so that they can get those dots arrayed, and then they can start connecting them as you have, because this is a huge body of work. So just roll with it, man. I'll jump in when...
Okay. Well, another thing that I have on my website, peterlance.com, a few pages below on the right-hand side, and it's still on the main page, but on a little bit below, you see a picture of this al-Qaeda spy named Ali Mohammed, who was the subject of my third book, Triple Cross. And earlier tonight I sent you, there's a 32-page illustrated timeline in that book that is really the epic, it contains the epic story of my investigation which begins with the murder of Anwar Sadat in 1981 and goes really through 9/11 and beyond. And that timeline was as of 2009 when we put out the trade paperback of Triple Cross. So those of your listeners that are connected to the web right now, if you go and download the timeline, you'll see how the counterterrorism investigation that I began right after 9/11 dovetailed and, you know, kind of pushed me, vectored me into this organized crime investigation. But in any case, just dialing back to, in order to have your listeners appreciate how I got into the TWA 800 story, I had been focusing my first book on Ramzi Youssef, and I went to the Philippines, and I proved that, in fact, the same cell, and this is about less than about 25 men are in this cell. This is a cell dominated by Blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who's their spiritual leader. It basically established a presence in New York at the Al-Farouq Mosque in the summer of 1989. And in the summer of 1989, John, on four successive weekends, the FBI Special Operations Group, the best of the best, their kind of black bag group, followed a group of Middle Eastern men from this mosque over four weekends out to this shooting range in Calvert in Long Island, which is like sort of above the Hamptons, way out on Long Island. And ironically, Calverton was also the location, but with no connection, just irony, that where they put the wreckage of TWA 800 together in a hangar. But on these four weekends in 89, when Bush 41 was in the White House, of the men photographed, the dozens of surveillance photographs were taken, John, at this of these MEs, they call them, Middle Eastern men. Of the men photographed in 89, July, three were later convicted in the World Trade Center bombing. Two were convicted in the plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels into Manhattan. One was just called the Day of Terror plot. One of them was the man who killed Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990. One who in 1990, I contend with that was the first blood spilled by Al-Qaeda on American soil. The man who trained them was Ali Mohammed, the Al-Qaeda spy, who actually was on a watch list, got into America, met a woman on the flight coming in. He was a stone Egyptian, ex-Egyptian army commando, total jihadist, and an acolyte of Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. And he first infiltrated a CIA operation in Hamburg, but his cover was blown. He was put on a watch list. Nonetheless, somehow got past the watch list, gets on a flight, TWA flight happened to be, into New York, and on the plane meets a woman named Linda Sanchez, and he was a real stud, you know, and he seduced her on the plane. They got married at a drive-through wedding chapel in Reno, Nevada, shortly thereafter. He's now living in Silicon Valley, John, where he sets up an Al-Qaeda cell, and he begins, enlists in the U.S. Army. Now, this is a former Egyptian Army commando, essentially, and he goes in as an enlisted man to stay under the radar. And where do you think he ends up? Where do you think this guy gets posted? The John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where the elite Green Beret and Delta Force officers train. And even though he doesn't have a top secret security clearance, he's a spy, and he knows how to steal documents. So on weekends, from there, he's coming up to New York, and he trains the cell that I just described that the FBI was on to. He trained the Calverton boys, okay? And the night Rabbi Meir Kahane was assassinated, the FBI, the shooter, El-Sayed Nasser, actually used the weapon on the rabbi at the Marriott Hotel on Lexington Avenue that was photographed by the FBI the previous year, you know? And he ran outside to Lexington. There was a gun battle, and he was wounded. The rabbi died, he lived, and that night the police, the FBI, Jersey State Police, I mean like six different police agencies raided his house in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. And John, they pulled 47 boxes of evidence out of that house, which included top secret memos that Ali Mohammed had secreted out of the JFK's WIC down at Bragg. One of them, which I have as an appendix to Triple Cross, was the location of every single U.S. Special Forces unit in the world at that time, latitude and longitude. And the Russians would have paid $1 million for that one document at the height of the Cold War. And this is an Al-Qaeda spy bringing it up to New York into this cell. So despite the seizure of these documents, there was also writings in Arabic that talked about knocking down the high world towers, the pillars of their strength. I mean, if they had a neon flashing sign with an arrow pointing at the World Trade Center, it couldn't have been more obvious, right?
Right.
But the next day, even though they found the getaway drivers, Abu Lima and Salema, who were also Calverton boys, they found them there. The NYPD declared it a lone gunman shooting. And Nasser was tried, and William Kunstler defended him and actually got him off the murder charge, but he was sent to Attica anyway for various gun charges. And Ali Muhammad was kind of in the wind. You know, Ali Muhammad, you know, just nobody made the connection to Ali Muhammad. Nobody in the FBI went and looked at the evidence.
Nobody in the FBI looked at the evidence.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I can say that with certainty, because the two principal agents at the time in the Joint Terrorism Task Force that were working, that knew about Nasser and were onto this, were called John Antisev, who was an agent, and Louis Napoli, who was a NYPD detective who was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Napoli, who I interviewed for my first book, said basically the evidence got passed back and forth between the Manhattan DA and the FBI, and nobody really processed it until after the World Trade Center bombing. And that's an absolute fact. And again, all of this, if you go to peterlance.com and you scroll down on the right and you see it, it's kind of a color picture of this guy, Ali Muhammad. It says triple cross timeline. And you start to read this, your jaw will be on the ground at the number of times, the number of opportunities, lost opportunities that the feds had to interdict the 9/11 plot. But I don't want to get too far afield. I want to get back to TWA 800. So what happened was, I'm doing this investigation, and I basically prove in my first book, 1,000 Years of Revenge, that it's the same cell. It's Ramzi Youssef after New York, when he failed to knock Tower 1 down into Tower 2. And by the way, again, when I say again, you're going to find in a minute that there was a problem of placement. When Youssef did the bombing, the wet test on the Philippine Airlines flight, he put the bomb in the wrong place. It was like two rows behind the fuel tank, and it didn't blow up the plane. The same thing happened in the World Trade Center bombing. He created this 1,500-pound urea nitrate fuel oil device that he drove in a Ryder truck to the B2 parking level under the North Tower of the Trade Center, with the goal of having Tower 1 fall into Tower, you know, the North Tower hit the South Tower. And what happened was, it was an incredibly powerful bomb. In fact, it blew through four floors of rebarred concrete, John, okay, downward. But if he had parked that truck next to the World Trade Center, as we later learned after 9/11 when they began to rebuild it, sat in a concrete bathtub that held out the Hudson River, 3-foot thick concrete bathtub, rebarred concrete, if he had placed that bomb, that truck, next to the concrete bathtub, the Hudson River would have interdicted. It would have made Hurricane Sandy look like a Disney movie, okay?
Yeah.
Entire Hudson, you can imagine, right? The kind of just mass destruction. So it was a placement issue with Youssef, but he was still a criminal genius. So he flees New York that night. By the way, nobody in the FBI thought to lock down the airports. They're running around that day saying Albanian terrorists. I swear to God. Okay.
Oh,
and nobody thought to lock. And I have a whole scene, a very dramatic scene in 1,000 Years of Revenge, where Youssef is at the first class lounge of Pakistani Airlines, and he's like, sure, they're going to get him, and they don't. And so he flees, eventually goes to Manila, where he sets up a cell in Manila in the fall of 94. Who's in the cell with him? His uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who the FBI later calls the mastermind of 9/11, but who, in fact, at the time was kind of a lounge lizard, kind of a screw-up, actually, not the mastermind genius that everybody thought at the time, but he was still Ramzi's uncle, and he was able to carry out Ramzi's plot. Also in this crew, located at what they call the Donna Josepha apartments, which I visited, was Abdul Hakim Murad, who is a Kuwaiti, one of Youssef's oldest friends. They're Youssef and Khalid Sheikh are Baluchistanis. They're from a region that is the size of France that intersects Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Has no defined border. And
tell you what, Peter.
Go ahead.
You got to hold up. You got to hold up right there, and just bring us right back to it when we come back. We got to take a hard break, okay? Peter Lance is our guest tonight. Wow. Keep your fingers close to your ears so your brains don't come out. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good to be with you tonight. Peter Lance is our guest. PeterLance.com. Check it out while we take our little break, because I want to get back to there are a lot of players involved here, and so I want to make sure we understand who they are and how they relate, and what the FBI missed, what they didn't miss, and just eventually we'll get into that crossover. I've said many times that the security services, CIA, FBI, and others that we don't even know about, frequently have to work with the underworld, because there is, well, to put it neatly, less paperwork to fill out. Accommodations can be made. Sometimes you have to do that deal with the devil. And Deal with the Devil is the latest book by Peter Lance. Check it out. Check out his website, PeterLance.com. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Peter Lance, just bring us back up to speed. Let's recapitulate now and reacquaint us with the players. We were talking about Ramsey's uncle, Ramsey's nephew, you know. It's kind of a long pause.
Ramsey's uncle. What I did was, during the break, I moved that timeline up a little higher on my front page. It's like about four down on the right, the Triple Cross timeline. And the without having to have your viewers get confused over Mahmoud, Mohammed, Mahmoud, you know, there are three different pronunciations of each name. But there are really, the simple way to put this is that there's really about 25 Al-Qaeda players in the cell responsible for both attacks on the Trade Center, the 93 bombing and 9/11. There's like 25 feds from Patrick Fitzgerald on down that are focused in the New York office of the FBI and the office of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District. The war on terror up until 9/11 was fought principally by investigated by the New York office of the Bureau and prosecuted in a series of cases by the Southern District. And that is, you know, that's essentially what was going on. So that's and that was the data that I mined in my first book when I began to put together this extraordinary story. To get us to the terrorism, to the organized crime story, and ultimately to TWA 800, my new book, Deal with the Devil, essentially takes what I learned in my first three books and goes to a whole new level. And it is, you know, with no humility, John, I can say the definitive book. It's going to rewrite the history, the perception of the FBI's war against organized crime. And the basis of my new book, and I'm just going to do one little 30-second paraphrase, because that's my HarperCollins would kill me if I got 2 hours into your show and only started talking about it then. The essence of this new book, Deal with the Devil, is that for 30 years, Gregory Scarpa Sr., a vicious mafia killer who stopped counting at 50 murders, who had a $70,000 a week drug operation, who was the largest trafficker in stolen credit cards in New York, who had an international auto theft ring, had a bypass bank burglary ring that would steal $13 million in a given heist on a weekend, who, you know, just had like $2 million on the street as a loan shark, would do high-end hijackings, not like Tony Soprano up the back of a truck with radios. This guy would hijack 1,000 cases of Cutty Sark or gold bullion, or he traded in negotiable bonds, John, with a $500,000 face value. He had a Pablo Escobar level income for years, and he was at the same time as while he was killing people and racketeering for 40 years, actually. He was a made guy in 1950, but from 1962 on, he was a top echelon informant working for the FBI, with his memos going directly to J. Edgar Hoover and every director up to Louis Freeh. And he was paid over $1 million in 2013 dollars by the feds and some insurance companies for his work. And yet they let him, they kept him on the street. Three different Justice Department strike forces tried to put him away. He only did 30 days and 40 years of mayhem and racketeering. And nobody has ever told the story the way it's told in this new book, Deal with the Devil. So,
I got to ask you, how did you gather this amount of information without pulling a lot of exposure while you were doing it?
Well, the thing is, the reason I chose the FBI, my son Christopher's high school was Stuyvesant High. His second day of high school, John, was 9/11. And Stuyvesant is like one of the best, probably the best high school in America. 28,000 applicants and about 800 get in. They take a test. And they built a beautiful new campus down by Ground Zero in Battery Park City. So my son, Chris, the day I find out that I dodged a bullet. You know, he was okay. Nothing happened to him. Although they used his high school for the next 3 months as a triage center for all the guys that worked on what they call the pile, you know, the yes. EMS and fire and you know, police workers. And but I had a friend named Ronnie Buca, who a fire marshal, courageous fire marshal, who died. Not only did he die, but he died on the 78th floor of the South Tower. He had made it up higher than any firefighter that day, with a battalion chief named Oreo Palmer, and he died with his boots on, a total hero. So after 9/11, I'd been working fiction. I'd been writing fiction. My middle career after ABC News was I was an episodic screenwriter in Hollywood, and I had been writing fiction. And I just said, I have to get back to journalism. I mean, how did this happen? Could it happen again? And you know, so I felt personally connected, even though I didn't have anything like the loss of many people. And so I just started to focus on the FBI. Why the FBI as opposed to the other four intelligence agencies? Because it's the only one that a journalist, a citizen like me, without a security clearance, could vet. And why was that? Because, as I said, basically the war on terror was conducted as a series of legal cases. The original World Trade Center bombing case in 94, the Day of Terror case, this Bojinka case in 1996, the second World Trade Center bombing case in 97, in which Youssef was convicted of that, and the African Embassy case in 2000 that Patrick Fitzgerald basically prosecuted. So those cases that were representing tens of thousands of pages of transcripts, I read every page of those transcripts. I began data mining. I read every book on the subject, and I began putting together my own database. I began developing sources. I went to the Philippines, and I just started on this journey, you know, and at every turn I would go, I can't believe this. You know, like some of the things you're hearing tonight, you're going, I can't believe this guy. That's what happened to me. But all of my books, my Forbes.com called Triple Cross Meticulous, recently book list called my latest book, Deal with the Devil Meticulous, because I'm dealing with the Bureau and auditing the FBI, I can't be wrong. So I have, like in this book, I don't know if you're holding it in your hands or if you actually got the physical book, but it's like 2 pounds, you know, and it has 2,100 endnotes, almost 60 pages of annotations. So that's basically how I got onto this. But I would develop sources inside the Bureau, outside the Bureau. A lot of retired agents believe in me. A lot of mob guys out of jail I interviewed, guys in jail. In fact, I got the first interview with Greg Scarpa Jr. And that brings us back now, I think, to the TW-800 story, if you want me to keep cooking.
Well, it's just amazing how all of this is interrelated. I mean, I've popped off a few times and said, you know, I've just picked this up as the years have gone by, that there really is a lot less paperwork to fill out if you can make an accommodation between the, you know, the forces of truth and justice, so to speak, and the dark side, you know, the underworld. But it appears that they do rub elbows occasionally.
Well, in this case, though, you know, somebody asked me the other night in an interview, in the Deal with the Devil, who really got the benefit? Was it the government or Scarpa Sr.? And I have to say, after having, you know, mined this data, there's no doubt that Greg Scarpa Sr. was won in the bargain, because not only was he the most bloodthirsty mafioso bar none in history, and if he really did stop counting after 50, that makes him one of the top serial killers of all time. But he also was a brilliant, brilliant Machiavellian tactician. And people who turn the pages of Deal with the Devil, and you can, on my website, peterlance.com, if you scroll down, salon.com just on Monday published the introduction. So you can just read the introduction, which is a good overview. And when you start to see how brilliant this guy was as a manipulator, John, like he snookered the agents who were controlling him, or allegedly controlling him. He snookered the Bureau brass. He was constantly claiming that he had money problems, so that he'd give him more money. And the guy used to carry a roll of $5,000 around with him at all times. He literally, what he would do is he would use FBI intelligence, and they would feed him to knock off his rivals. And he would either by murder or by getting them indicted. So he became the main source for the Title III wiretaps on the Mafia Commission case in 1986 that propelled Rudy Giuliani to the mayor's Gracie Mansion and ultimately made his political career. You know, the Mafia Commission case was the one that, in which three of the bosses of the five New York families, Tony Salerno of the Genoveses, Tony Corallo of the Lucchese's, and Carmine Persico of the Colombo family, which is what the family of Scarpa Sr., they all went to jail for life. And Scarpa basically was the guy on who they relied for the probable cause to do the wiretaps. So he was a very important snitch to them, if you will. On the other hand, he operated with reckless abandon. Three separate strike forces of the Justice Department, one in Newark, one in Chicago, and one in Brooklyn, tried to put this guy away. Good people in our government doing earnest work, right, trying to get this guy off the street because they knew how bloodthirsty he was and how corrupt he was, and the FBI was backdooring and going in and protecting him at every turn. And in fact, when the Secret Service busted him in 1986, when they found out he was trafficking in stolen credit cards, and, you know, counterfeiting is their bailiwick, they busted him, and he could have gotten $250,000 fine and 7 years in jail. Instead, Lynn DeVecchio, his last contacting agent, who was the supervisor in the New York office, went to the judge and basically said, cut him some slack, he's really valuable to us, and they left him on the street. And in leaving him on the street, he was alive to instigate what became the third war in the Colombo family, during which 14 people were killed. He killed six of them himself. So arguably, if he'd just been brought to justice the way the Secret Service and the Strike Force had wanted, those people would still be alive today. So if you're asking yourself who got the benefit of the deal with the devil, Greg Scarpa, no doubt.
And what happened to him eventually?
He contracted the HIV virus from a blood transfusion, can I just say this? There basically is a blessed trinity, in my opinion, John. You check me if I'm wrong, of mob stories that have been put to film. Godfather 1 and 2, I don't like to include this Godfather 3, but Godfather 1 and 2 is one leg of the, let's call it the triple crown, okay? Casino and Goodfellas is the second leg, and the Sopranos collectively is the third leg. And you look at those three, you know, entities, and you say, how can one ever tell a mob story that hasn't been told already? How do you do it? What do you do? This book does it. In fact, there's enough in this book to sustain two miniseries on the order of Band of Brothers in the Pacific. It is, every single chapter has something in it, even if you're a mafia buff, even if you're a Cosa Nostra aficionado, right? Even if you're a wise guy in jail or out, when you read this book, you go, I don't freaking believe it. You know, it's like, it's just because that's how original Scarpa was. One last little anecdote before I get back to TDWA. Will you indulge me? Can I just?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, listen to this. He gets married to a woman named Connie Forrest, who is the mother of Gregory Jr., his son, who started working for him at the age of 16. And they have three other children, and he moves Connie to a horse farm in New Jersey. He's got a Kentucky Derby level horse farm in New Jersey. That's how lucrative an earner he was. And while he's married to Connie legally, he takes up with this beautiful young woman named Linda Shiro, Linda Diana. And on the right side of my website, about four down, you'll see a shot of him dancing with her. And she'd been dating wise guys since she was like 15. And they fall in love, and she becomes his guma, or essentially his common-law wife, in Brooklyn, while Connie's out in New Jersey. And he has two children by her, little Linda and Joey. And because they don't want the children to feel like they're, you know, not legitimate, quote-unquote, Linda marries a guy named Charlie Shiro, who actually thinks those are his kids. And, you know, she leaves their house in the morning and goes over and sees Greg. So later, when Shiro finds out, he divorces her, but he doesn't. It's not a rough divorce, because then he realizes who she's with. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, he doesn't go too far. And then, while living common law with Linda and legally married to Connie, in 1975, Scarpa Sr. goes to Las Vegas and marries Lily DeJani, a former Miss Israel, who looks like Gina Lola Brigida, okay? And buys her, John, with cash, an apartment on Sutton Place, the most exclusive block in Manhattan, with cash. And he sets her up there, and that's his personal life. But now, while he was viciously protective of his family, years later, when Lily was having an affair with Eli Skolnick, a doctor who performed abortions, and Scarpa basically found out about it, he had him murdered. He had Dr. Skolnick murdered. Having said that, when he found out, Linda came to him once, and she saw this young little guy looked like Frankie Avalon named Larry Mazzi. He was a local delivery boy, handsome guy from the local market. And she said, Greg, you know, I'd like to fool around with him. Is that okay? And he says, sure, honey, anything that makes you happy. So she would make love to Larry Mazzi. He'd come over during the day, and Senior Scarpa would watch them from somewhere in the house. And later, he adopted Larry as kind of his surrogate son, taught him, like, you know, how to rob banks and be a lookout and how to drive. And then right. he basically became his principal killer in the Third Colombo War.
So, unbelievable.
Talk about complicated.
How did these guys get away with this for so long? I would think that, like, throwing down cash for a for an apartment in an exclusive part of town would at least get the attention of the IRS. Something.
Well, you know, you are way ahead of the curve, dude, because, ironically, the Skolnick murder was related to an alleged leak. Skolnick apparently had called the IRS about Scarpa.
Really?
You're very prescient, John. You're way ahead of the curve. And understand something. Every time federal agents of parallel federal agencies, or the NYPD, by the way, or the Brooklyn DA, would try to intervene to get this guy off the street, the FBI would use their muscle to get in to keep him on the street. So he had interference run constantly, and he came to believe that he had a license to kill. His favorite show was Mission Impossible. He used to call himself 007, among other things. They called him the killing machine, and he would often sign notes, KM. I mean, he reveled in it, you know? And when you have that kind of protection and juice, by the way, one of the more astonishing things in the book, which had come out earlier, this story has been told before, but I think I told it in the most definitive way in the book. In 1964, when the three civil rights workers, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were missing in the South, remember, they were killed by the Klan, they found their burn station wagon, and their bodies were missing, and oh, yeah. the film Mississippi Burning chronicles that. Well, Hoover, Bobby Kennedy, they were freaking out. They sent hundreds of agents down combing Laurel, Philadelphia, Mississippi, couldn't find the bodies. And the FBI, in the movie, they send down a black agent. No, there were like half a dozen black agents at the time. Untrue. This is what happened. The Bureau recruited Gregory Scarpa Sr. under what's called, they called him a special. They flew him down to the Fontainebleau Hotel with Linda Shiro for a couple of days of R&R. Then they flew him over to Mobile, Alabama, and ultimately drove him to a hotel in the area, and they gave him a gun and cash, and he gave Linda a packet of cash and said, if I don't come back, honey, you know, go home. And he then went and proceeded to kidnap the mayor of a town who was a KKK member, and he tortured this guy. First he threatened to shoot him, then the guy gave him bogus information, then he put the gun in the guy's mouth, cocked it. The guy was still more afraid of the Invisible Empire than he was of Scarpa. And then Scarpa pulled out a straight razor and threatened to, you know what, his private parts.
Right.
And that's
right.
When the guy gave up the bodies.
Man. Well, so you're answering one of my questions, which is why do these guys, why don't they just make some money and then quit? You know, the whole deal in Godfather 1 was, yeah, we want to eventually become legitimate, but I guess it's like a drug and it doesn't wear off.
You know something, that, again, you really ask a perceptive question, because I asked one of these guys recently that had, you know, been like 9 years, you know, and he's out. And I said to him, listen, what kind of person is in a business where at any moment of the day you can be whacked? You know, remember the scene in Goodfellas where Joe Pesci says, I don't have a shine box anymore. And he just goes after that guy with like a fountain pen and just stabs him to death in a bar.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's like these guys, whether they were like had a contract put out on them formally that was approved by the commission, or whether it was just a couple of guys that didn't like each other and they'd whack each other. It's like that, you know, life expectancy was very short in the mafia. Right. So I would say to these guys, why would you do this? I mean, aren't there better ways to make a living? And they would always say, man, it's the cash, dude. It's the cash. I mean, Larry Mazza, this guy had actually wanted to become a firefighter. His father was a firefighter, and he went to John Jay College for a semester, dropped out. And when he finally got adopted by Scarpa, he and his partner, Jimmy Del Mastro, had $2 million on the street in a loan shark book. And they were making, like, hand-over-fist money for a certain period of time, of course. And then, you know, they ended up, both of them, doing time. And they're lucky they're alive today. But the lure of easy money, as Glenn Frey said.
Yeah, good food, good wine, the babes, the action, the money, I'll tell you. Oh, man. All right. Well, let's do a little news and a few other things and come right on back with Peter Lance. Check out the site, peterlance.com. You'll enjoy it. This is Coast to Coast AM.